G'day and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour and I have on the line two good friends, starting with Mark Christensen. How are you, Mark?
Hey, Mike. Good to talk to you.
Is there any reason why your nickname is Bootkins?
No,
it's kind
well,
of a bit weird, man.
There is a reason. It's my Star Wars nickname way back. I did a trailer for Rebel Assault 2 at LucasArts and I played the pilot that gets shot out of space, and we gave him a Star Wars name. So we gave him Bootkins. I wasn't on camera, but I did the voiceover.
Well, that's a good excuse. Let's see if John Flowers can come up with a good excuse for his nickname on Skype. John, how are you?
I'm doing really well.
And you're Kadensky. Oh, this is a complete rat hole before we even get started. But anyway, do you have such a good reason? Were you doing anything for Steven Spielberg, perhaps?
No. Actually, when I was a kid, I took Jeet Kune Do and some martial arts for about 11 years. And one of my instructors referred to me once as Kinendose, which is a really old school insult of saying like a self-taught person who refuses to have a master.
I see. Well, with that out of the way, we're here to talk about Star Trek this week and wanted to also start actually with an apology. David Strapinas was trying to be with us, but we had a scheduling clash and he wasn't able to make it. So hopefully we'll get him back in a couple of weeks' time. But David is out, as it happens already, for the next couple of weeks. So it was a shame we couldn't be with us today. But guys, I think if David was here, he'd be joining us, and I imagine is a universal kind of acclaim that we actually really liked the film this week. Is that the case, John?
Yes, I loved it. I also should say that much like JJ himself, I am not a fan of the original Star Trek, and I apologize in advance to the people who will be throwing mental stones at me for that, but I just did not like the original Star Trek. I was a Next Generation and Deep Space Nine fan.
And what about you, Mark? What did you think of the film?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah?
I think we're here to celebrate its greatness and hopefully not gush too much about it.
Well, we'll discuss, as we always do, the film in broad terms, and then we'll go and discuss the visual effects work, of which obviously there was a large amount. I guess the leading off the pack is the whole fact that this film is a prequel, as it were. It's a sort of a reboot at the same time. And it's been a while since we've seen a Trek film. Mark, had you seen the previous Trek films?
Oh, the most recent ones? No. I have to say I'm different than John in that I got the biggest energy for this series, for me, came off the original. And I did not really dig on The Next Generation. And the more ossified and kind of heady and left brain these things have gotten, the less interested in them I've been, I have to say.
Well,
so this one, you know, we've got green sex with green aliens again in this one. So yeah. It's
yes, well, I guess if we're putting our cards on our table, I did see the original series when I was a kid and thought it was good. I thought that that and Space Station 1999, I thought was always really good. But yes, I was a huge Next Gen fan and Voyager fan. Not so much the one that came after that, which I've sort of blotted out. But yes, definitely Deep Space Nine was good, but Voyager and Next Gen. And I like the fact that this film by Abrams is not the path of going down the dark, gritty, evil, tortured path. Not that there's anything wrong with that. We loved it in of course, Batman. But I'm glad to see that this didn't decide to reboot by just turning it on its ear. And I think had it done so, it would have been not nearly as successful. Would you agree with that, John?
I would agree with that. However, I don't want to paint an entirely beautiful and loving picture of this film because Nero is tormented and just brutally mean. I mean, he's a pretty nasty villain.
Yeah. It's funny for me being an Australian because Eric Banner, as you guys may know him, is a terrifically accomplished actor and was great in Black Hawk Down, for example. But the film that got him into Black Hawk Down was a film he did where he played a psycho modern day hitman. And I don't mean like a fictitious one. I mean, there's an actual guy in Australia who's quite well known as heavily tattooed, half an ear because he got bitten off in a fight kind of guy that is really serious. Even me talking about him now is probably a dangerous thing for me to do. And Chopper Reid, and they made a film about Chopper and Eric Banastarden. Now, what's extraordinary about this, and the point of my anecdote, is that when he decided to do this role of Chopper Reid, an indie film with a sort of brutal R rating, it was such a extraordinary casting against type, because we knew him for a decade as a really, really funny stand-up comedian. And of course, Americans know him as this hard-ass, you know, Black Hawk Down evil character that he is in Star Trek. And it's, I find that it's extraordinary, because he really is incredibly funny. Like, he was on TV, like our version of like Saturday Night Live, as a stand-up comic. And it's hard to imagine making such a strong transition. But look, in this film, I agree, he's great. He doesn't look anything like Eric Banner, though. What did you think of the kind of makeup on him, Mark? Did you think our Romulan evil guy was a good-looking villain?
Yeah, he's scary and creepy. I might go as him for Halloween, now that you mention it.
So one of the things I think that's interesting about this film is that while we've said that we've had a reboot here, they are doing something that allows for a massive, obviously spoiler alert, massive time twisting, ripping a hole in the fabric of the space-time continuum kind of deal that allows us to also have one member of the original cast turn up, and we end up with two Spocks on screen. And I must say, for me personally, I loved that. I've loved Leonard Nimoy, and as Spock, I think he brought a lot to the performance. I'm glad it was not just a token part, but his alter ego, the young Spock, was as equally impressive, I thought. From an acting point of view, John, did you enjoy the performances?
Oh, absolutely. And I have to say that I enjoyed every single performance in this. Simon Pegg was breathtakingly good, right, as Scotty. Just, I cannot believe how good a job he did. I mean, again, everyone did a fantastic job. I even liked, I guess his name is Anton Yelchin, the person who played Chekhov.
Yeah, I thought he was good.
There's been a little bit of controversy over here, but the thing is, if you go back to the original Chekhov, I mean, that dude is weird. And
oh, yeah.
So you needed this kind of strange and, you know,
and
I mean,
young.
They just turned the weird to 11 on it, and I thought it worked out fantastic. I loved it.
We did an interview with Carl Urban as well as J.J. Abrams himself on FX Guide, and I had a really interesting time talking to Carl Urban about finding that character, because he plays Bones, and as is the case with Kirk or any of these lead characters, they had very, very iconic speech patterns and very iconic, to the point of caricature. You know, often someone doing impersonations would rip off Kirk's stilted speech patterns. And so it was interesting, I think, how the actors approached finding those characters, because they sort of got the cadence down and they've got this lovely intonation and sort of feeling of the character without necessarily doing the caricature, without being silly. In fact, I found at no point did I feel I kind of cringed because they were trying to be an actor, trying to be that character in Trek. Would you agree with that, Mark?
Well, I think the Chekhov case is maybe a special case, because it does seem like his job was to take it a little bit over the top, actually, and have a little bit of a good time with that one. But I do agree. It was, you know, it wasn't a yuck fest. These are iconic characters. It's really striking to me, you know, we in American culture use Star Wars interchangeably with the Bible in terms of, or Hamlet or other great works in terms of how people refer to these iconic characters in casual conversation. But seeing these characters come back and brought back to life, and, you know, they each had maybe their one-liner, their sort of famous thing that you could throw in, or their three things. And those were done really nicely, almost as throwaways in some case. But meanwhile, I felt like there was blood in their veins.
Yeah, I thought it was good. I didn't want to see them just being a caricature or a kind of bad imitation of a bad Shatner doing a bad Kirk. I mean, for you, John, like, did you feel that they were those characters or they're all new characters?
No, I absolutely felt 100% like they were new characters. All the way, you know, you talked about Carl Urban. I mean, Carl Urban played McCoy, or, you know, Bones, if you will, in a way that had a little bit of the sort of original DeForest Kelly in it, but it also, he felt bipolar to me. I mean, he felt like there was a serious personality issue going on where you couldn't tell, you know, emotionally what was going on with him. And like, he was a real person. And I think I can't say it enough. Every single person was so richly drawn, and all the way to the ship, which is not a person, but it was a character in the film. Everything was just so rich and detailed. This was one of the better films I've seen in a long time.
Yeah. I guess I was hoping that's not even a criticism. I was hoping that we'd see some more of Winona Ryder, because I kind of like the whole, I like her, you know, early stuff. Anything that was directed by Ben Stiller is kind of my kind of thing. And so, absolutely. Of all the cast, I think Zachary Quinto, they're all really, really good. And I thought it was a good, well-made film. But at the end of the day, I think you just touched on it then, John. For me, it was character-driven action film. It's exactly what I want. In fact, I wanted the lens flares. So for me, it was perfect, right? It was action-driven in the way Die Hard was. And it looked like a glary 70s, 80s, or an 80s action film to me. And it felt visceral. And I'm going to get to the visual effects in a second, but it really came through for me also in the visual effects, especially on the fight sequence on the mining platform. You know, that felt real. The fact that they shot it outside really helped. It just, you know, it was quite tangible. And I loved the detail of the fact that when you're in the Enterprise, they're, you know, first on board, there are steel girders, you know, and there were like bolts and rivets and stuff. Like, this was an age, obviously, before some of the tech that we had. And so instead of just dealing with that in a weird way, they made it a much more constructed, manually, you could see where the joins were, kind of Enterprise, as opposed to the slick ones that that came after it. And I don't want to get into a whole discussion of whether the engines were, you know, faithful to the original or not, but I'd like the interior sets, I thought, were appropriate. Did you sort of like the environments that they had the guys set to, John?
I loved it. And, you know, there were a couple of things that were very, very striking about this. The first thing was, it was clear to me that in this reboot, they made a decision that this was a time when Starfleet was truly an academy. It was truly a military, organization. And you get away from that, I think, a lot in the Next Generation and Voyager. And as it follows, it becomes this kind of peacekeeping sort of, you know, it really diverges from its military roots. But this felt to me like, you know, the military would eventually start making, you know, having contact with other planets, and we would form this galactic, you know, or universal military. And this would be the beginning of it. And it felt very real in that way. And then the other thing that felt real to me was, you know, the Enterprise would be a hot rod. I mean, let's face it. You build, you know, the first set of ships that get built are going to be like muscle cars.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think that was very realistic.
Yeah, I thought it was good. I thought it was really good. Well, let's start talking about the visual effects work. And leading the pack was ILM. And I think that if you're going to do this, ILM is a magnificent company, and they have a rich history with Trek, and Trek itself has a rich history with visual effects. Let's not forget that sort of pivotal points in computer graphics history, like the Genesis sequence, was in a Trek film. And so it's not uncommon to see a Trek film as a vehicle for doing some amazing work. And yes, over time, we've had some criticisms of the films, but then the budgets did shrink quite dramatically during the course of the of the first sort of 10 films, that they would know that they were going to get an audience of only so much, so they would allow only so much of a budget. They never tried to kind of grow it out because they didn't think they were possible to do that. So they started sort of reducing down what was possible. And by the end, they were producing what I think was very good, but almost glorified TV eps without kind of the reaching for the stars kind of sense of what you could do with a major tentpole picture. Now, coming back now in 2009, this is totally the blockbuster tentpole picture of the summer, from what I can see. Is there anything else on the horizon, Mark, that you think is going to like eclipse this in the short term?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's certainly a bunch of other sequels. One of them could hit, but
In the current batch of films, this film, it was moved by Paramount to a summer release, has been given a huge amount of marketing support. But the very fact that they didn't release it and actually sat on the finished film effectively for 6 months because they thought it was that good shows quite a commitment from the studio, way beyond what they would have committed to on the, say, the last Nemesis film, I think.
Yeah, I mean, they clearly sensed the palpable excitement and saw what they had.
Do you like J.J.'s work, like J.J. Abrams' other work, like Mission Impossible 3, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a liveliness to his work I really respect. I mean, one thing that I, stepping back, like my 10,000 foot view of this film and the place where I think it's something of a landmark is, you know, ILM has now moved over to doing everything digitally. There is no model shop. Kerner Optical didn't do any work on this. And, you know, even things that you would have done practically, you know, just because we like them that way, like, you know, some things exploding and things like that, weren't done that way. And apparently, you know, there's no need to. I mean, they've figured out how to model, you know, I mean, they were modeling imperfect lenses on this show as well. And you, in the hands of the wrong director, that is kind of a dangerous way to go. In the hands of this director, you know, this is a director who wanted to get everything he could on the day, on the set. He's always trying to get what he can. And it's a fantastic combination, frankly, because, you know, that and the fact that they got the thing done early and actually had an opportunity, evidently, to polish it.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary because okay, so I'm going to do it again. But anyway, sorry, I apologize about this. But we also have an interview with ILM over the visual effects of this on FX Guide. That's a separate audio podcast. And what I didn't realize, I knew that ILM had struck some kind of, I don't know, goal with having both Harry Potter and this delayed in release so as to allow them to actually be existing in a world that didn't have killer, crusher, last-minute schedules. But what I had thought is that they'd finished working on Star Trek when they were meant to in December, and they just sat on it in the shelf effectively for 6 months. Though, as we learnt in that interview, they did actually go back and do some polishing, including tidying up a few things and like tiny, subtle stuff, like getting the continuity, for example, in Eric Banner's character and his makeup and stuff, things like that. So there were some polishing and some edits and some tweaks done. But yeah, I mean, this, you know, how often have we sat here, guys, and spoken about killer schedules and how no one has enough time to do anything properly? And here's a film that obviously has benefited from having a bit of time to breathe, and obviously the visual effects house has had a chance to finish its work properly and not have to rush anything out the door. I mean, John, this just never felt rushed, did it?
No, it didn't. And in contrast to the film that we talked about last week, my understanding of this film is that the budget was $20 million less than last week's film.
Really? I didn't have that. That's interesting.
Yeah. So $130 versus $150.
Wow.
Million.
Because this feels like a bigger film to me.
Absolutely. It feels like double or triple the budget to me just based on just the vast, vast amount of detail in everything. You know, we talked about the ships and what they were able to do with the ships and just the amount of detail on those ships with no models. That's shocking to me. I've heard other people, I think Alex on Twit mentioned that he could tell that there was some issue with the ships, but I couldn't tell the difference between whether these had been practical or they were 3D or CG. I thought the ships were just very well done.
Look, I totally did. And it didn't at any point lack the visual detail that we come to associate with, you know, with really good miniatures work. And it didn't have any of the plastic feel. But, you know, it is ILM, and ILM is really good at what it does. And this, at one point, pretty much consumed ILM. They had, like, a huge proportion of the permanent staff working on it. And, you know, like, it shows. And I think good on them, because this isn't a film that really, in a sense, there's some R&D kind of breakthrough stuff, but this isn't a Benjamin Button where you can point to a significant technology that, you know, advanced the art. I think the implosion of Vulcan is really well done and obviously involved a bunch of R&D, but it's not, you know, like a film that screams out they had one new trick and look how well they played it. This is just a really well done film. And quite frankly, we've seen a lot of stuff in space. I mean, there's a standard joke now that you don't want to lead your showreel with space shots because, you know, someone like ILM has done them so well that it's almost impossible to do them better. But the brief to do spectacular shots of spaceships and have them look fresh and original is pretty darn hard. I don't know if you guys read any of this background, but they went to a lot of trouble. For example, the way the explosions happened, you know, in that first opening sequence where, in fact, it's Kirk's father who does this wonderful scene of saving the lives of the crew while losing his own. In the explosions on the ship there, they did a lot of work to model how explosions would actually happen in space, in that there would be an explosion that would be fueled by the gas coming out from the ship, but then it would kind of implode back because they would run out of oxygen, but the inertia of the debris field would run contrary to that because it would have nothing to slow it down. It would continue. And so that's a level of kind of detail that we don't often see in these kind of space things. I don't know. Did anyone, Mark, did you like notice anything? I mean, I thought it was really well done, that opening, that sort of fight attack sequence.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, the space shots in this movie are full-blown works of art in many cases. And again, the confidence in this movie of taking color and composition, taking the ship itself, you know, and making it both truer to the original ship, but also having it do stuff that that ship could never do because it was just a dumb plastic model hanging by a string. And, you know, but not just for its own sake. I mean, really, for the right reasons, just livening this stuff up and just composing these shots. I mean, the composition of the shots, the color of them, you know, they're just gorgeous to look at, really. I mean, just really, really nicely composed, and like I would, I mean, I think to me the rewatchability of this, a lot of it is in the richness of the visuals and you know, what's on the screen, even, you know, maybe some of what's left out. I don't know. I hadn't really thought of it, you know, beyond what's in the film. But, you know, as you watch it more, I think you'd see, you know, more of the choices that were made.
I mean, they had me from that trailer sequence of the young Kirk getting in trouble, losing the car, and then pulling up a few years later on his motorbike and seeing the Enterprise being built on Earth. Like those,
which makes no sense at all, right?
No.
I mean, it doesn't. It's so anachronistic.
But yet,
but it makes complete sense in the spirit of the film.
Yeah. I mean, it looked great. It was a well-composed shot, as you say, but also the whole, you know, him tearing away with the car and pranging it, well, somewhat improbable to say the least. You know, it was the spirit of a rebellious, but it was also kind of cool and funky. And you know, this film has to be appealing to more than a standard Trek crowd. Otherwise, it just wouldn't be doing the business that it's doing. I mean, John, you said you weren't a Trek fan, but obviously Trek fans are likely to go and see it anyway. But, I mean, if we weren't reviewing it for the show, would you have gone? Did you get a sort of sense of it from the trailer as being a film worth seeing?
Absolutely. And, you know, to be clear, I mean, I wasn't a fan of the original Star Trek. Like I said, I was a big fan of Next Generation. So, but here's the thing. So there's, I saw the trailer like you did, and I thought, wow, this is going to be spectacular. And, you know, my wife also saw the trailer and just knows absolutely zero about Star Trek, like has never seen any of it. And she saw the trailer and she said, wow, I want to see that movie, you know?
Yeah, I thought it was great. And, you know, talking about these visual effects, I want to come to that specifically, that scene on the, which is composed hundreds or at least 100 and something plus shots, the skydiving down to the drilling rig. See, for me, where it really started to stand out is just, this was not shot green screen on a stage. You know, they bothered to build that whole set, or not the whole set, but a sort of partial set of it, on top of a car park outside Dodger Stadium, so they could film with a real sky and a real shoot off, but with tons of sky and tons of clear air, and not put up green screens and shoot at all. And look, people have quoted J.J. Abrams as saying that he green screen makes him crazy, but in fact, what it benefits from is not so much that it's a green screen problem; it's just that the use of the natural light there. Those scenes when they fight the guys on the top of the drilling rig, I just thought it looked really, really well lit. Like, it looked terrific. It just looked believable. And it would have been an otherwise an absurdly staged sort of, you know, studio piece. Didn't feel like that at all. Mark, do you with me on that? I just didn't look
absolutely
great on that time.
You know, the only stuff in this movie that felt gimmicky and effectsy was deliberately so. I mean, having a guy stuck in a tube, you know, and getting flushed around the engine room. It's like, it's just a funny bit, right? It's not, it's,
I thought
not
you were going to go for the giant hands.
Yeah, that's another good one, right? You know, those obviously, they're pointing to themselves as a visual effect, but it's used for a really funny piece of business that, again, I just, my hat's off to the confidence to go ahead and just do that. I think it's because this director wasn't particularly a fan of the series and, you know, took ownership of it to, you know, making fun of something is a pejorative term, but in this case, it's really making some fun, you know, in Star Trek.
It's got fun with it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So in terms of visual effects sequences, I can completely tick my standard weekly box of how the car shots looked out the window, because there were no times that I felt we had the bad window comps. I would be totally remiss if we didn't mention the lens flares, because they are probably the most discussed aspect of the visuals, though actually not a visual effect, primarily done in camera. Did the lens flares hit ridiculous points? Is that, do you think, valid, or do you think it's just beat up on the net?
Oh, yeah. The net is full of people with an opinion. And here's mine. So here's what I know. And I did a lot of research on this because I thought every single one of the lens flares was practical. And it turns out that's not the case. It turns out that when you're inside the ship, the lens flares are predominantly digital. And anytime you're not inside the ship, the lens flares are practical. You know, they used a halogen light and basically just shined it across the lens of the camera to create some of these lens flares. And they had all of these lights and they had different names for them. And I mean, you know, they had this whole constellation of lights going and they would be like, okay, Orion, you know, let's go. And they had all these different ways of doing it. For me though, it practically made the film. I mean, if I could, you know, list three things about this film that blew my mind, you know, the acting is clearly at the top, the story and the fact that J.J. Abrams was just not afraid to take something so cherished and really fall in love with it in the right way, in a modern way. So the story is just amazing. And then the look of the film, just from start to finish, I loved every second of it. I loved the fact that there were lens flares. I mean, I just felt like I was there. And I think that's
I love that glariness. And I think that, you know, it was put in there to make it so that some of the set pieces weren't quite so static and boring and give this idea that something was happening off screen. And you know what? It worked for me. I really liked it. I thought, if you study them and look at them and stuff, there are quite a lot of them, but it's adding a stylistic element. And, you know, stylistic elements, you know, do draw attention to themselves a bit. I mean, you know, it's not, I don't get a lens flare when I look at a scene myself. I, you know, it's an optical of lens coatings that happen in lenses. It's obviously drawing attention to the filmmaking process in a way that is 100% naturalistic. But, you know, a little bit of stylized filmmaking never went astray. And I think it would have been a visually less interesting and film. And also there's something about the lens flares that said new and crisp and clean and sort of almost squeaky clean that I think, you know, was warranted, because it wasn't... It seemed to highlight those shiny surfaces and those whites in the interior of the ship. Are you with us on this, Mark?
Yeah, I would even go so far in the bridge, which is where they're really at their apex, to say that it creates this almost heavenly or godlike atmosphere to the bridge of the ship, if you will.
Yeah. I thought it worked, yeah. I hadn't thought of it in that respect, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and they're quite over the top. Some of them come blaring through the frame when you're on the bridge and you wonder, where am I that I'm getting that level of light coming in on me? I'm just looking at two guys talking to each other.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what about the...
But it doesn't really matter.
What about the actual more full CG effects? We've just touched briefly on the planets discussion. Mark, are you... if you had... Obviously, as it would be at some point in the script, Vulcan implodes. Yeah. Do you think that was a valid interpretation of it visually?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they built a whole piece of software to do it, right? Or they had a piece of software that they used to do it, which is theirs. Yeah, my gosh. What can I say? It really was interesting to look at. It decayed in a, you know, fascinating way. How would a planet actually implode into a black hole? I have no idea. I think it would happen much more quickly than that, but that's okay. I'd rather be able to sit back and watch it a little bit.
I thought that implosion of the planet worked slightly better than the end sequence. Let's not get sucked into a black hole by blowing up the black hole and riding the shockwave out, which to me was a slightly less original and also slightly more like, does anyone know that a black hole means that you can't escape a black hole? Because that's what a black hole is. So I kind of, the surfing the black hole thing, black hole rim surfing didn't strike me as being, it was like one of the few times in the film that I was kind of like, yeah, okay. I don't care how good your, you know, impulse warp drives are. And I know that that means you can go faster than the speed of light. And but I'm like, light can't escape a black hole. It's the fundamental reason why the darn thing's black, right? But Vulcan was, I think, really lovely in its detail and quite sad in its implosion. And I mean that in an emotional sense. John?
No, I agree. I thought the implosion worked very well. I don't quite have the same sort of rigid sensibility about being able to escape from a black hole.
I'm being too idle, right? I'm being too...
Well, there's this entire possibility surrounding the quantum state of the core that they ejected. And, you know, you just like, you don't want to get into the whole science of it because I'm an armchair scientist at best, you know, so I can't speak to that. I can speak to the... You know, they had, I guess his last name is Posh. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but there's a professor who is basically a professor at Carnegie Mellon.
Absolutely.
And he, that guy is a computer scientist. He's a visionary computer scientist. And so he came up with a tremendous amount of just the technology behind it. So I can speak to, as a technologist, that I think a lot of the technology really, really worked and was just fascinating. I just spent, you know, the whole movie having to remind myself, okay, where are the visual effects in this? Because I'm supposed to review this thing. And instead, you know, I just found myself getting completely lost in just the beauty of it, so, all the way from the planet explosion to everything else.
So were you referring to Randy Posh, the author of The Last Lecture?
Yes.
Have you read his Last Lecture?
I have.
I thought it was an incredibly moving book. Have you read it, Mark?
No, I haven't.
Do you know what we're talking about, or should I fill you in?
I'm aware. I mean, he had a cameo in this film as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. And he literally, for those that don't know, there's a tradition of a professor giving a last lecture. And unfortunately, the reason that he was leaving Carnegie Mellon was that he had terminal pancreatic cancer, and he wrote a book based on the lecture he gave where he discussed a whole lot of things and how he fulfilled his life set of ambitions, which some of which were just extraordinary, like, you know, being an Imagineer at Disney, and one of them, you know, was being in Star Trek. And I think it sounds dumb saying it now, and it sounds like it's going to be one of those books that are like, you know, I'm going to tell you how to get your life together kind of thing. But the book's really good, and definitely I think he's discussing the fact that to a certain extent he was spending what precious time he had writing this darn book, right? Which, I mean, to a certain extent, you know, was that a selfish thing to do in relationship to his wife? And these are sort of issues he discusses. But I was kind of taken aback when I discovered he had a cameo in it. Did you like the book, John?
I was a big fan, and it does sound a little bit on the self-helpy side, but it's very thoughtful and it's very engaging. And I should point out that I sat in the third row of the main hall with a red pass in 2007 at the J.J. Abrams TED Mystery Box.
Oh, really? You actually saw that one?
Yeah, I was in the audience. I actually spoke on stage for 3 minutes that year as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so like, so that's two interesting things. I have to tackle the first one first, right? Which was the mystery box one. Because, you know, when I interviewed Abrams, I referred to that lecture about what was the mystery box in Trek. Wow, that was an amazing lecture. That's on YouTube if you guys haven't seen it. It's part of the TED series and definitely worth a look. And wow, that must have been amazing to actually hear that in person, though. I can't imagine what that would have been like.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. It was... it's also one of the reasons, you know, I went in with really, high expectations because I had heard that Adrian Brody was originally signed up to play Spock.
Right.
And so my expectations were really high because I am a big fan of Adrian Brody. And I thought, if you're going to punt Adrian Brody, you better do something good with it. But I also went in with high expectations, you know, because having seen that, and just really following J.J. Abrams after that, right? Because, I how could you not fall in love with the guy after seeing that presentation?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you realize here is a guy who gets it.
There's another presentation that was on the net. It was on cable television in America. It was a dinner party. And there's basically a dinner party of, like, six guys, of which he's one of them. And they just have this dinner party, and they film it. And he spoke then about what it was like to get the initial phone call from Tom Cruise to be in directing Mission Impossible 3, because it was around that time. And I just, again, same thing, I've sort of man love for J.J. Abrams after hearing that. And then I saw, of course, that thing. And then having met him in person, he's just everything you expect him to be. He's such a nice guy. But hey, tell me, the second bit of the thing, I can't skip over that. You were on TED that year as well?
Yeah, I did a 3-minute talk about...
How could I not know that?
A temple that I visited in Thailand.
Oh, I think I did know that. I think you told me that. In fact, I think you gave me the pictures and I completely spaced on it. I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, how cool. How immensely cool. Total, you know, major kudos for being in TED, because, wow, what an amazing institution, I guess you'd now call it, of far-seeing and insightful lectures. Without a doubt, one of the most interesting things I've never been to, yet alone having, like, you lecturing at it. Do you been back since? Do you go this year?
Yeah, I try to. I also go to TED Global when I can. They have something called TED Global, which takes place in, you know, Africa or England or those sort of things.
But, wow.
Yeah, I'm sorry to derail the conversation with that. I just...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's just too cool for words.
well, thank you.
Unless I should say, Mark, have you actually given any lectures at TED?
Oh, please. I can say that there is a TED app for the iPhone that I have downloaded.
Okay, well, all good news. So the reason we got into that is that the last lecture, and I must admit there's a lot of really nice little trivial aspects about, well, maybe not so trivial aspects about this film. I was interested that I saw Gene Roddenberry's wife's credit in the end, because she's always been the voice of the Enterprise computer, but I thought that she had died. And, of course, when I looked it up, I discovered that she, in fact, did die about 2 weeks after she did the last of the voiceover work for this. So this film is has, I think, a dedication to both of them. But, yes, she was the voice of... And also, if you're a Next Generation fan, she was Loxana Troi's... well, perhaps you could explain exactly her role in Next Generation, John.
So Deanna Troi was the psychic who may or may not have had a love interest with Picard or Riker. It's very complicated.
Never with Picard. That was always...
Well, that's true. That was always the Whoopi Goldberg character.
No. It was Beverly. Not now, Beverly. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. So although I do think that Whoopi Goldberg's character... did have some kind of weird relationship with Picard as well. But anyway, getting back to Deanna Troi. Her mother, Loxana Troi, I guess Majel Barrett is her name. She played the mother of the psychic, and she was very, you know, very in touch with her emotions and things like that. But she also was the voice of the computer as well. So it's kind of a strange paradox of seeing her and hearing her and then hearing the computer while she's in the same room, and you thought, wow, this is...
Yeah, she reprised that role also in Deep Space Nine. So that was a kind of touching thing that that she finished out the show, and I guess to a certain extent brought to an end really that major kind of overview of the Trek world from the original series. But this is like a film that's been going for a long time. But as I said, I really think that the role that it's played in the history of visual effects is kind of an interesting one as well, because do you guys remember when face scanning first appeared? That appeared in Trek in one of the films where they scanned all the cast for, I think it was the one where they tried to meet God. And there's been a whole lot of really interesting visual effects things. In fact, one of the first uses of tracking, image tracking and proper, was done on Troy in Next Generation. The actual advances of Harry/Flame digital compositing to bring television episodic work in line with feature film work was all pretty much pioneered by Next Generation. Next Generation came through at a time when that technology was just breaking through and it had enough of a budget to sustain it. And we saw a big transition because Deep Space Nine was still all done with miniatures. And then by the time the last Star Trek TV show went to air, they'd sort of pretty much moved to digital models entirely. And so there's a, you know, whatever you think about Star Trek as a franchise, there is actually, from a visual effects point of view, it's been a really big funder, if you like, or a supporter of state-of-the-art visual effects. And if you were to somehow put a montage together of all the key visual effects elements in the film, I think you'd be surprised at how many kind of ring true. We tend to, I think, to give Star Trek second place to Star Wars in terms of its visual effects pedigree. But for obviously a long time, Star Wars wasn't on the screens. It was, you know, a period of three films, a huge gap, and another three films. Whereas Star Trek, apart from this last gap, has been pretty reliable over many decades, and so has been a real kind of opportunity for many visual effects artists to kind of earn their stripes and move forward. And I think it was nice that that the work done here in this film was back with ILM, because I somehow kind of link ILM with those original Star Trek things. Did you guys, were you at the age, I guess, that Genesis and those sort of sequences really impacted you? Because, I mean, I remember when the Genesis sequence came out, it was just an astonishing piece of visual effects imagery.
Well, I remember having a lot of respect. I mean, it really called out that it was this very ambitious and grand and you've never seen this before sequence. And, you know, so, I think I would use the word respect even at the time. I don't know if it was life-changing for me. I think if I were more of a computer graphics geek at the time, it might have been.
I was getting into fractals at that time. I mean, I was really like a fractal geek. Like I was like a Mandelbrot groupie. And so for me, it was just the secret to realism in computer graphics was going to come from a Mandelbrot set. And so that forming of the planet was just, I don't know. I mean, I literally still to this day have the fundamental text upon which the science of that was, I actually nicked it from Sydney University Library. I had to pay a vast fine when I refused to return it. John, did any of this stuff resonate with you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember the Genesis sequence as well for the same exact reasons that you do, although on a completely different side, right? The fractal patterns. I mean, I was endlessly fascinated with you know, the idea of like Conway's Game of Life and these very simple things creating something extraordinarily complex. I mean, I was writing search engines and doing all this weird stuff like that. The idea of fractals was very fascinating. So I obviously, just by virtue of being conscious and somewhat in that space, you know, I heard a lot about the Genesis sequence and I found it completely amazing.
Well, look, to finish out the show this week, because we've obviously been pretty gushing about the film, I don't want to turn it negative. So I'm going to say, is there any particular one scene or visual effects aspect that if you were to point your finger at? John, you already had a chance to name sort of three things you thought impressive about the whole film, but was there one sequence that, you know, when watching it, you thought, knowing that you're a VFX show co-host, that you were like, wow, that's good?
Well, so it's going to be a weird one probably, but when young Kirk dives out of the car and the car goes over the cliff,
yep,
you know, and the motorcycle's chasing him, that moment, that sort of car going off the cliff, him diving out, just the way the camera moved, that entire interaction, I thought to myself, man, I wish I'd done that.
Yeah, it had a kind of cool rock and roll shake to it, didn't it? That leap in slow motion.
And it was unlike anything I have ever seen before. And the yardstick for me is, you know, is it breathtaking and unique? You know, I have this kind of like, I want to gasp, you know, I want to lean forward and just gasp, right? or lean back and gasp, depending on the scene. And I also want to walk away going, wow, I've never seen anything like that before. And, you know, we've seen Bullet Time and we've seen The Matrix and we've seen all this crap where people are jumping around. This felt completely different than any of that. I just, the way that, like I say, the way the camera moved, the way he came out, the way that every aspect, that had to be, there just had to be so much CG in that jump. I can't even believe it.
And what about you, Mark?
Well, I think there were shots that had really just so many layers of detail that I was trying to look at them. And these are space shots. So in fact, it's, as you say, it's a hard arena in which to distinguish yourself. But particularly with that really complex Romulan ship in there and the battles going on, you know, there were just so many planes of really interesting, organic, beautiful, you know, dynamic things going on.
That, what about Nero's ship, man?
It was cool. I guess for me, well, there are two things. Firstly, I want to, we haven't mentioned it, but I think Lola's work on the greened alien chick that is in Uhura's, you know, Starfleet Academy.
That was the shot. That's the one I wish I'd worked on.
Yeah, she that was really good work from Lola. I think they just are very good at doing that kind of stuff now, that digital makeup. And, you know, if you ever tried doing something like that, it just seems really simple and it's actually really, really hard. I guess for me, the killer shot, because it's something I could almost imagine myself working on, not that I'm saying I'm that good, but, you know, like, whereas some of the procedural stuff, I can't imagine what it would take to code those. So it's kind of outside my area. But I just honestly think the motorbike pulling up and that matte painting shot of the Enterprise with the depth queuing of it, with it under construction, was just such an exquisitely, beautifully framed piece of anything. I would happily get a frame of that, blow it up and stick it on my wall, the size of the wall, really. Yeah. So that would be the
That's
shot.
That's an iconic shot.
Yeah.
Absolutely iconic shot.
Just goes right into the realm of, oh my God, I wish I'd worked on that. But look, there are some other companies other than ILM, as we said, that worked on the film. We give a lot of credit to ILM because they were the lead house. And we're going to wrap it up for this week. But this is actually our third anniversary of the VFX show. And I should tell you that in coming weeks, we have some really great stuff coming up, including one of the original hosts of the VFX show will be making a return guest appearance. He's promised me that he'll do this. And it's not how you think it is. But John, do you want to flag some of the people that have contributed to the last 3 years of what has been the VFX show?
Absolutely. You know, if I'm going to try and rattle through this quickly, and I apologize to the list, but it's pretty extensive, and we've had some really great folks on. Obviously, there was Alex Lindsay in the beginning and Ron Brinkman and John LaBrie, I believe I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Then Mike, you've been on a few times. Kenji Kato was on at one point. David Strapinis, Mark, you're on quite often. Matt Graham, who I actually kind of miss and would like to see on more. I've been on a few times. Krista Martin, of course, has been on. I actually was on an episode with Igor Ryabchuk, and that was a great one. Obviously, great movie as well.
Into Russian cinema, yeah.
Absolutely. Jason Wingrove and Lori Apthorpe as well.
Yep, absolutely. And we want to thank KM because she's our producer and our organizer and our person that suffers our incredibly complicated scheduling problems.
Absolutely.
So we really, really appreciate that. We want to thank you guys for being with us for 3 years and supporting the show. And I have to say that we took a bold move this last year when we decided to branch out and start doing some retro pieces, some looking back at some great films from periods past. And they have actually turned into being some of the most successful shows in terms of downloads that we've done. So thanks for walking with us that extra distance. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. I want to say thank you to our co-hosts, Mark and John, as always. Thank you, guys.
My pleasure.
And I want to apologize again to David, who got bumped out due to a scheduling crisis. We love you, David, and we're sorry you couldn't be with us. Until next time, guys, you can follow us on the Twitters. I'm Mike Seymour. John, what's your Twitter
life
handle?
Zero. And yeah, life zero.
And Mark?
Flow Seeker.
And you've got two, and you need to approve me on the second one,
no.
Dude.
Oh, I did approve you.
Oh, okay.
Oh, Mike. That's just so that I can follow more people without...
It's the private one. Yeah. I just want the private thing. I'm all about the private party thing. I have to go because I'm about to be interviewed myself for something for cable
for
television.
Ted. Oh.
So, no, not for Ted, though I'm way impressed with that, John. Totally respect, man. Until next time, guys, thanks so much. We'll catch you on the flip side. See you.